The actual title of the class, which was Martial Arts in Halakha, I just expanded that a little more to include all contact sports. The truth is, this is a little bit of an exercise in the halakhic process. Because obviously, not every situation that a person will find themselves in the course of their life, and certainly not every situation that every Jew will find themselves in the course of history, is possible to write down. The way halakha works is that there are cases, there is a text, and there is a tradition, and there's a methodology, and there are sources, and we apply the methodology to these sources to derive what exactly the law is in any particular case, in any particular situation. If you look through the responsa literature, which is rabbinic responses to contemporary issues, you find that there is an incredible range of issues that are discussed in these books. I mean, everything you can possibly imagine. There are responsa about all types of medical ethics, organ transplant, abortion, euthanasia, etc., drug abuse. There are responsa about sexual ethics of all types, incest and adultery and sexual abuse in the workplace and so on and so forth. You have social issues, financial issues, every single law. And, you know, if you look through, for instance, Moshe Feinstein, upon whose responsa some of this is based, every single question he was ever asked, and he has thousands, he found an explicit source in the Talmud that deals with it. There was not one source, there was not one question he was ever asked, which he didn't just go straight to the Talmud and say, here's your source, this is what it's talking about. Some say that the Gaon of Vilna, great sage in Lithuania in the 19th century, was able to do the same with verses in the Torah. As you would ask him any question, he'd be able to go straight to a word in the Torah, he'd read the verse, and when he read the verse to you, it would be clear and obvious what your answer was. Just the inflection, the emphasis, etc., of how he read it would give you your answer. So, we can't do that. But what we can do is look at some of the sources about a particular issue. So, the issue is contact sports. Why did I come to think of this? Well, for a few reasons. First of all, I used to do a bit of karate, and I had a sparring partner who is I'm not advanced at all, but he was a very advanced black belt in full contact karate, and had also done boxing for about 10 years. And prior to that, he'd been in a street gang in Manchester, which was also a valuable experience for him in the field. And he and I used to spar in our bomb shelter in our building. All Israeli buildings have bomb shelters. We used to have had a heavy bag there, mats, and we used to spar. Anyway, one evening, we injured each other. Not badly. I had broken his glasses and cut him around the eye, and he gave me a large bruise on the forehead with a headbutt. And we're both married, children, you know, we're both sitting there and wondering, you know, is this permitted? It struck us that maybe it's wrong. I mean, maybe, you know, could be it's prohibited to do this. I mean, you know, like, it entered our minds, right, this idea. And so hence, I decided to look into it further. Obviously, I came out that it's okay. But we're going to see the process here of why we thought about that. You know, and the truth is, I still I don't do much of it anymore. Nunchaku, I do, but my kids, three of my boys are into judo, and one of their teachers is a Hasidic Jew, who is a black belt, second Dan in judo. He does fights, full contact fights in Tel Aviv on a regular basis. He says he does it mainly for the, just for the fun of it. He goes into the ring and with his payas flying, and we've got these, like, you know, these jocks from Tel Aviv who see this guy and then he destroys them. You know what I mean? It's always a lot of fun. Yeah. So, they have one teacher who studies Torah half day and teaches judo the rest of the time. One of my kids' first class he went to, he said, wow, he says, Abba. I said, what's the teacher like? How is he? He says, he's very good. He says, he's even older than you. I said, oh my God. Like, they let him teach with the oxygen tank and everything, and, you know, how they let him out of the old age home and stuff. Like, So we do actually, we are involved in this stuff in my family, with the exception of my wife and daughter. But let's have a look at what the Jewish law says about it. First and foremost, why is it all a problem? Well, obvious. Code of Jewish law says, it is forbidden for a person to hit his fellow man. And if he does hit him, he transgresses the biblical prohibition, you shall not smite him in excess. That is referring, that doesn't mean that I can hit you a certain amount, but not a lot. Right? The context of that verse in the Torah refers to someone who has been sentenced to corporal punishment by the court. So the court says he's got to get this and this many lashes, corporal punishment for his crime. So there's a biblical prohibition that says don't smite him in excess. So if the person of the court gives him one more smack than what he's meant to get from the court decreed, this guy is now considered as transgressing assault and battery. He's done assault and battery. So that's what it means, don't smite him in excess. And it says, if this refers to the court-sentenced criminal who's getting this, and there's a biblical prohibition against giving him one extra piece of pain or whipping, etc., he says, how much more so does this apply to an innocent human being to whom you are causing pain and hitting? So that's a prohibition. And not only that, but the Code of Jewish Law goes on to say, one who raises his hand against his fellow man with intent to hit him, even if he does not hit him, is called a rasha. He's called evil. So even if you raise your hand, you don't hit him, that already is an act of evil. How do we know that? What's the biblical source for that? Anyone know? So Moses is the source of that. Moses sees two Jews fighting, and one is about to hit the other one. And Moses says, rasha. Lama takere echa, evil one, why are you going to hit your friend? What is the implication? The fact that he's about to hit him, even though he hasn't done it yet, already Moses called him a rasha, an evil person. So we see from here, it's not just the actual, I think in civil law, there's a similar idea, there's battery, which is the actual hitting of someone, and assault is the threat of violence on someone. So here also in Jewish law, you have both of those. So now clearly, according to that, how could you possibly engage in martial arts? How could you possibly engage in football, for example? Let's just touch football, but tackle football, how could you do such a thing? Rugby, Australian football, right? These type of sports where chances are, and in many of them, your intention is to immobilize, to hurt, etc. Then how could you possibly be involved in this? Maimonides, one who smites in a destructive manner has transgressed a negative prohibition, you shall not smite him in excess. Maimonides adds a word in here, which I think is the key to understanding the prohibition. Look at Maimonides, look at the Code of Jewish Law, and tell me what the difference is. Number one and number two.
Destructive manner.
I'm sorry, what did you say? That's right. Maimonides says, in a destructive manner. What does he mean here? Well, supposing I'm a physician. And, I have to, a neurologist might want to determine, your nerve response. May I stick a needle in? Oh, it hurts. Right? I'm suing you. Well, I mean, right? He's meant to do that, right? Or, for example, he cuts you, a surgeon cuts a person. Why is he allowed to do that? The answer is very clear. The prohibition of the Torah is written in the form of nitzah. It says, it's the context of the prohibition is a destructive manner. What if you do it in a constructive manner? Well, like a physician healing someone, like a neurologist testing someone, right? This is something which, according to Maimonides, would be no prohibition. Now, is it conceivable that sports or martial arts would be considered constructive as opposed to destructive? That depends. If your intent is to hurt the person, it's destructive. If your intent is merely to, I suppose, engage in the game and to teach the person maybe how to defend themselves, right, or to teach yourself how to defend yourself, right, is that constructive or destructive? It appears to me that would be constructive. But the Mishnah says the following. We have a bit of a problem. The Mishnah says, number three, one who says to another person, blind my eye, cut off my hand, or break my foot, and the other person does this, the second party is obligated to pay for damages. If he says, on condition you'll be exempt from damages, he is nevertheless obligated to pay. So if you go up to someone and say, break my foot, blind my eye, cut off my hand, And the other person says, are you sure? And they say, absolutely, I'm not going to sue you for it. And he does it, you can sue him. He has to pay damages. Why? What's the logic of that? Why do you think that's so? The other guy said, do it. So he's saying it's because he's got a responsibility. It's not his body and he's got a responsibility to take care of it. Perhaps that's one possibility. The Gemara seems to imply slightly different. Let's have a look further on. Because it says the following. One who says, you're right. That is actually part of what the Gemara says. One who says, tear my clothing or break my vessel, and another does so, he is obligated to pay. But if he says on condition you're exempt, then he's exempt. So if on the one hand, blind me, cut off my hand, you're not exempt, even if the guy says you're exempt. On the other hand, if he says, break my glasses, rip my clothing, and you do so, and he says, on condition that you're exempt, you are exempt from payment. So you want to ask what the difference is. The Talmud answers, the difference is very simple, the Talmud says. In one case, we say permanent injury, a person, we assume, does not forego. He's not serious when he says it. No one seriously, you have to assume that the person's not serious. When the person says, blind my eye, you've got to assume he's not serious. And if he's not serious, you cannot do it. But if he says something which is a temporary damage, like pain, or something like a bruise, or break my glasses, tear my clothing, that is something which we can assume that you are serious about when you say that I won't sue you for it. You're exempt from damages. In other words, we have a certain assumption. Is the person likely to really say that it's okay to permanently injure him? No, it's not very likely, right? If it's not likely, then you don't have the right to assume that he's being really serious. You've got to take into account that, I don't know why, he's nuts, maybe he's joking, whatever, he can't do it. So what we have here is a clear distinction between two types of damage, a permanent damage and temporary damage. So in that sense, Rav Moshe Feinstein, for example, was asked by an American football player, a Jewish, I don't know who this is, I don't know what year it was, but I don't know how many Jewish American football players there are. But this person made his living from American football, so I assume he was professional. And he asked Rav Moshe Feinstein, this venerable sage in New York, is it permitted for me to engage in that? Since I could injure people and I could be injured myself, am I allowed to engage in this? Now, you've got to imagine, Rav Moshe Feinstein was very far from American football. You know, like very often, I know, I always think of this, there's friends of mine in Toronto, their great-grandmother from Russia, first time she saw American football on television. She's sitting there watching it, and she says, terrible. Why don't they buy a ball for all of them, and they won't have to... I don't have to fight like that, Mama Schneller, you know. She was like, she's like, you're very pained by it, you know. I actually have a friend who teaches at Rosemach in Jerusalem, who used to be he was in a semi-professional baseball, team. And, he was also a rabbi. He actually also was a martial arts instructor at the New York Police Academy. He's a rabbi at Rosemach now. He was a martial arts instructor at the New York NYPD Academy. So anyway, he asked Rav Moshe Feinstein if he felt it was appropriate for him to be playing baseball. He's a rabbi. What if he is? You know, he's playing baseball regularly. So Rav Moshe Feinstein asked him, "What's your batting average?" He tells him. He says, "Is it good?" He says, "Okay, fine." Right? You know, he says, "On the contrary, he says, if your batting average is good, it's a kiddush Hashem, yeah, sanctification that I have got." Actually, at Or Sameach, about 15, 16 years ago, we used to regularly have baseball games between staff and students. And I remember about 15, 20 years ago, Rav Schiller, who was the Rosh Yeshiva, used to play regularly. He used to play Rav Schiller and Rav Weinberger, the registrar, and a lot of the rabbis used to play. And Rav Schiller is standing there at bat, right? And along Shmuel Anavi, the street there, Shimon HaTzadik, another Rosh Yeshiva, dean of another yeshiva, walks by and sees Rav Schiller. Right, he's jacking the hat off, standing there with a bat, right, and he says to him, I just switched to the Braille sheets, okay, just one second, let me hear that. Yeah. So, he sees Rav Schiller at bat, anyway, he doesn't interrupt, but as Rav Schiller finishes, right, he actually hit a home run, and Rosh Hashiva says to Rav Schiller, it's not a desecration, it's a chilul Hashem, Rosh Hashiva, he says, it's not a desecration of God's name for Rosh Hashiva to be playing baseball. So Rav Schiller said, only if we lose. So But there is this, so he asked Reb Moshe Feinstein. Reb Moshe Feinstein didn't say it was inappropriate. Reb Moshe Feinstein said, it's okay. And one of the things he quoted was this Gemara. He says this, if you are entering into a sport in which there's contact, in which there's a possibility of injuring someone or being injured, he says the main criteria that makes it permitted is, A, you don't intend to cause permanent injury, and B, the person knows full well what he's getting into, and C, there has to be an explicit statement of mechila, of, that is to say, foregoing damages to the other person. In other words, before we spar, instead of just doing this, right, what we're supposed to say is, we don't have to do it every time we spar, but say basically, I forgive you, I will not, you are exempt if you cause damage to me. And the other guy says, and you're exempt if you cause damage to me. We have an explicit mechila, an explicit forgiveness of the other person for injuries you could cause. Now, this only applies to temporary injuries, pain, etc. Permanent injury is still something which can be, damages can be asked for in a court of law, a court of Jewish law. Right? But if it's a temporary damage, if it's something which will heal, if it's just pain, then that is considered something you can forego. So the first, one of the things he points out is, providing the person involved in the game, or in the sport, both are aware of this possibility of damage, then each one is allowed to forego to what's called a mechila to the other person should they cause this damage. Now, however, what remains is there's another problem. The other problem is that we know, and as you mentioned before, that your body is not considered your possession. The body of a human being is ultimately something which we have to take care of, but ultimately belongs to God. In fact, if you have a look at the Gemara, I know it's a little difficult, number four, the Gemara Bava Kamma, right, which says the following. Which of the Tanaim, that's the authors of the Mishnah, said that it's forbidden for a person to wound himself? It says, your blood, this is in Genesis 9, your blood I shall require from your soul. It says this, Ach et damshchem lenafshatechem edrosh. I will, God says, a person who spills the blood of his fellow man, I will seek his blood. And he says, your blood I will seek from your hand. Now what does that mean? So the Talmud answers, what it means is, God will seek payment, that is to say punishment, if you spill your own blood. That's actually the source for the prohibition against suicide. Suicide in Jewish law is considered like murder. Murdering yourself, murdering someone else is murder, Right? And the souls belong to God. That's the origin, one reason at least, that in Jewish law, if a person confesses to a capital crime, we don't execute him. Because we don't accept his confession about something which he doesn't possess. If I say, I confess, I owe you $1,000, even if I don't owe you $1,000, I've got to pay. It's my money to dispose with as I wish. But if I say, I give up my life, we don't listen to him. It's not yours to give up as you want. So your confession is meaningless in a Jewish court in a capital crime. So, but again, Rebbe Elazar Kaffer says that from that prohibition we derive that it's prohibited to injure yourself or to commit suicide. And in addition, he quotes another idea. It says that there is a fellow called a Nazarite. What's a Nazarite? Is a man who takes, or a woman actually, who takes an oath that for 30 days they will not drink wine or any grape juice products, they will not come in contact with the dead, and they will not groom their hair, not cut their hair or groom it in any way. So a person would take a vow like that. Generally, they would take a vow like that if they felt they were too hedonistic, materialistic. They'd take a vow to go in the opposite direction for a temporary time. So it says at the end of that period of 30 days, the Nazarite has to bring a sacrifice, a sin offering. Why? To atone for that which he sinned against the soul. So the Gemara asks, which soul did the Nazarite hurt? What do you mean sin against the soul? He didn't hurt anyone. Whose soul did he hurt? Talmud says his own. Now, how did he hurt himself? Did he actively hurt himself? All he did was refrain from certain pleasures and permitted pleasures. He refrained from certain permitted pleasures, and that's considered to be sinful. So how much more so would it be to cause yourself pain? So, okay, financially you're safe because I've told the other person's told me he's not going to sue me. And I'm safe, and he's safe because I've told him I'm not going to sue you. But how is it permitted for me to put myself in a situation of danger? And even to put myself in a situation of pain, how is such a thing permitted? So the answer here And not only that, but if you have a look also at Maimonides, Maimonides says a person has to distance yourself from things which are harmful. So how is it permitted for you to put yourself into such a situation? So the answer that Moshe Feinstein gives, this is in number 5, he says the following. The lights are actually on outside. I don't know why they're not working here. Maybe if I... Oh, it's the whole hotel? Oh, okay. Fine. So he says the following. It says that when a person does work for you, in the absence of any prior agreement, you are obligated to pay the worker his wages the same day that he works for you. So you hire a gardener, so there's no usually, let's say, in Western society, you've got 30 days to pay your accounts. But let's say you didn't make any agreement. So you've got to pay him that night. You should not pay him the next day. You should not leave the wages overnight. And it says, it tacks on to the end of this prohibition, you shall pay him. It says the following, ki elav hu noseh et nafsho. Now, what does that mean? It says, because for that wage, he gives his soul. He gives his soul. So some commentaries say, what does that mean, gives his soul for the wage? So the Gemara says the following. The Gemara says, why does he go up on a plank and hang on a tree and put himself in danger? It says, let's say a person who works by plucking fruit from a tree, right? Or a person who fixes roof tiles, or a painter, or an electrician, right? A lot of professions have got danger involved. It's not just being a professional boxer is more dangerous, okay. But being a physician can be dangerous, especially nowadays. Okay, being certainly an electrician, there is certain danger there. What about, we know that airline travel or traveling by ship is considered to be putting a certain amount of danger, yet you're allowed to do so for the sake of business and making a living. So what do we see? The Torah says, since the worker gives his very life for the sake of his wage, in other words, he puts himself in danger for the sake of his profession, of making a living, it is so important to pay him on time. It's as though you're taking away his very life, which he is prepared to give. So Rav Moshe Feinstein points out the following. He says, it is evident from here that it is permitted to place oneself at a slight risk for your livelihood. This is also true where one risks killing someone else, as there is no difference between killing yourself or someone else. In both cases, you transgress, not murder. Of course, this is only true where the others enter into the risk voluntarily and with full awareness. So in response to this professional football player, Rav Moshe Feinstein wrote that he says, look, he says, true, you are at risk, and you're at risk of being hurt or hurting someone else. You're even at risk of being killed or killing someone else. He says, but nevertheless, since the Torah says, without criticism, that one of the reasons you have to pay your worker on time is because of the mesirut nefesh, the giving of his very life, putting his life at risk for the job, he says, and the Torah doesn't criticize him for that. On the contrary, it bases a commandment on that reality. He says, we see from here that it is permitted to put yourself at slight risk for the sake of livelihood. Now, if you put someone else at risk, that's a different story, unless that person has consented. If that person has consented, then it's also permissible. So Rav Moshe Feinstein says, if your livelihood would be based on something which involves a certain amount of danger to yourself, or to others, like the case he's talking about, professional football, or perhaps if you're a martial arts instructor, he says such a thing would be permitted. Now, is it too much of a stretch from that? Why, let's say you're not doing martial arts or contact sport for the sake of a livelihood. What other reasons would you be doing martial arts or contact sport for, if not for livelihood? Health, self-defense, right? Now, are health and self-defense valid? Is health a valid reason to... Well, I would say, Maimonides first of all tells us in the laws of the intellect, a person must distance himself from things destructive to the body and conduct himself in ways that are strengthening and therapeutic. We know that according to Jewish law, there is an obligation to keep your health, to act in ways which are healthful, eat healthful food, etc., etc., aside from the occasional seminar, right? But to basically keep yourself healthy. And Jewish law obligates you to do that. So there's no question that it's considered a value, right, in Jewish law to keep yourself healthy, to do exercise, any exercise whatsoever. I would say, I don't know about, virtually any exercise involves some degree of pain, some degree of stress, jogging, weightlifting, right? Even aerobics, right? Virtually any exercise involves some degree of stress. So that pain is permitted, because why? Again, it's constructive. Again, even if there's some risk, it will be considered very similar to earning a living. Earning a living and keep yourself in health, right, certainly are on the same par. I would say probably, you know, keeping yourself healthy is tantamount, exactly the same as earning a living. In addition, the Jewish attitude to self-defense also would kick in here. Judaism is not pacifist. Pacifist, generally, we would define as someone who says that violence is never justified. That is not the Jewish point of view. Although we do not glorify violence, the culture, Jewish culture, is not a culture that glorifies the gun. I mean, there are cultures where weapons are considered to be holy things. I have an acquaintance in Detroit, who is a master of an Indonesian martial art. And whenever he takes his sword out to do a kata, which is type of like a stylized movements with a sword, he always takes it out and touches it to his forehead as a sign of respect and reverence for the sword. I know in Japan, there is a reverence for the katana, which is the actual samurai, there's a special sword, and it is treated with a great reverence. There are many cultures where wearing of a sword and a weapon is considered to be a sign of honor. In England, that was so for many, many hundreds of years. It's true, I suppose, in certain parts of the United States, the obligatory gun rack in the back of your pickup truck with a Confederate flag and a mangy dog and a John Deere cap, right, I believe are tools of the trade in certain parts of America, right, and there's a virtual worship of the gun by certain elements of society. So in Judaism, on the other hand, although there is some dispute about this, but the halacha, the vast majority of sages and the Mishnah say that to wear a weapon as if it would be an adornment or a decoration on the Sabbath is prohibited, because weapons are an embarrassment and a shame for humanity. So you can wear a weapon if you need it for self-defense, but to wear it because it's an ornament on the Sabbath, that is, if you're carrying it, that is something prohibited, because a weapon is shame, it's an embarrassment. Rav Kook points out another interesting example of that attitude. All posts amongst the Jewish people, all leadership roles, go automatically from father to son if the son is appropriate. The head of the Sanhedrin, the court, the high priest, the king, etc. There's one exception. Anyone know the exception? Doesn't automatically go from father to son. The one exception is a kohen, who is the priest who is appointed to go out to the army camp in the times of war. So the priest who goes out to the army camp in times of war was, if he died or retired, his son would not automatically get it. They'd have to reappoint someone else. Rav Kook says, why? He says, because the idea of going from father to son, father to son, father to son, like the Davidic lineage, etc., what does that symbolize? Continuity, natural continuity, right, eternity. He says the one area that we don't want to show that perpetuation, the one area where we don't want to have continuity is what? War. He says so we specifically break that cycle as if to say, you know what, it's an unnatural state, right? Halavai, would that it be that we won't have to replace this guy because we won't have a war anymore? And that's the emotion and that's the philosophy which is represented by this detail in Jewish law. So, therefore, on the one hand, we abhor violence, and we are not people who glorify that. Even today, in the secular state of Israel, I remember seeing a picture in the Army magazine. Ehud Barak, at the time I did basic training, was the chief of staff of the Israeli army. And a member of the Argentinian armed forces, a very senior member of their staff, came to visit Israel. And so you had Ehud Barak standing there in, like, really not very well ironed uniform, with a couple of what they call falafel on his shoulder and little round things. And next to him was standing, and paratrooper wings. Next to him, this Argentinian general was covered head to toe with braid, with medals, with, it was unbelievable. The sun shone off this guy. You were blinded by it. Right? Had he been shot at, it would just bounce off the medals. Right? And so they're standing next to each other, and I couldn't help noticing the contrast. Ehud Barak looked almost embarrassed, right, of his military record until elections came around, of course, right? But he looked almost embarrassed, and this Argentinian general who lost the Falklands, right, still part of the Commonwealth, right? So he's standing there with all this amazing, you know, glorification of war. So that's the Jewish view. However, having said that, We're still not pacifists. We believe, as opposed to Matthew 6, which says, turn the other cheek and resist not evil. Judaism says, don't turn the other cheek. And of course, Bertrand Russell points out in his book, Why I Am Not a Christian, that the only time turn the other cheek was applied by Christians was when they talk to a Jew who they just hit on one cheek. Would you please turn the other one? Oh, good. Thank you. Right. So, but he says, but the Torah says that the right of self-defense is inherent. Right? You're allowed and obligated to defend yourself. As it says in the Torah, right? The Gemara in Sanhedrin, puts it this way, Haba lehorgecha, one who comes to kill you, hashkein lehorgo. What does hashkein mean? Get up early. I.e., proceed and kill him first. You're allowed to even take a preemptive strike in Jewish law in a case of self-defense. So we would understand that that's an inherent right, an inherent obligation is to defend yourself. Right, to resist evil and to defend yourself and family, and you're allowed to defend your property, and all this is considered to be appropriate. Of course, you have to use a certain, the degree of force that you use has to be commensurate with the attack upon yourself, etc. But nevertheless, the idea of self-defense is incorporated in the Torah. It's actually in the Bible itself. It talks about if a thief enters a house which is populated, then that thief, you're allowed to kill him as soon as he comes into the house. You're allowed to kill him. Why? So the Gemara explains, because when he goes into the house and he knows there's people there, he knows it's the nature of the house owner to defend his property. And if it would come to a contest between the thief and the homeowner, would the thief say, you know what, I don't really want violence here, I'm just going to leave? Of course not. In his mind, he is prepared to murder. If it means going to jail, if it means getting caught, if it means paying the fine, if it means not stealing, he's prepared ultimately to murder the homeowner, and consequently, the homeowner is allowed to take the preemptive strike. As soon as the guy comes into the house, he can kill him. This is not true in America. It depends on the state you're in. I was told that in Texas, you can kill the guy on the way in, not on the way out. So a lawyer there told me, says, I advise my clients, right, to shoot him, then drag him back in and turn the body around. So anyway, but he says the Talmud says that, that one certainly is allowed to defend oneself, and even in a case like that, where the assumption that the guy is a potential murderer is enough for the homeowner to defend himself, give himself the benefit of the doubt. You don't have to give the other guy the benefit of the doubt, and shoot him in self-defense. So we see in Judaism as well, even though we're not passive, even though we abhor weapons, and we abhor violence, and we're not a culture of that, but nevertheless, we are certainly not a pacifist culture, and we don't believe in sitting down and being trodden on. We believe that you have the right of self-defense. So that also is a value within Judaism, and that's something which we feel is just like earning a livelihood, just like acting in ways healthful to the body. So also the ability of self-defense, also something which is certainly in consonance with Jewish philosophy. I just wanted to point out the Mishnah in Kiddushin discusses what a father is obligated to teach his child. So it says, obviously he has to teach him Torah, and he has to teach him a trade, the means of making a living. But it also says, it adds, some say he has to teach him how to swim. It's a little strange. Teach him Torah, we understand. Teach him a trade, we understand. Why do you have to teach your son how to swim? Rav Samson Raphael Hirsch, in his book Chorev, says, what the Torah is really telling us, what the Mishnah is trying to tell us is, look, Torah is the spiritual preparation for life. Preparation for survival spiritually in life. He says a living, a trade, is the ability to earn a livelihood so you can support yourself and your family and actually live a life of Torah. He says, but in addition to that, there are other survival skills that might be necessary. Right? Maybe to swim is a survival skill. He says, whatever survival skills are necessary in a particular society, you should have to teach your child. If you live in New York, you've got to teach him not to make eye contact on the subway, right? To go around corners like this, right? That type of, you know, basic stuff that you have to know in New York, right? So you have to teach him things like this. So also, I would say it may be, depending on where you live, depending on the type of society you live in, it could very well be that under the obligation of teaching your child how to swim, maybe teaching him how to do an asotogari, right, in judo or something like that, right? So that may be another justification, at least, for a positive value in the martial arts. There is one final issue that we should cover. As we've covered the idea of injuring someone else and being injured. Injuring someone else is covered by the idea that A, it is for a constructive purpose, as the Maimonides points out. B, the idea of foregoing, mechila, the foregoing of my right to sue you and the exemption of each other from damage. We also mentioned that that although there's a prohibition to hurt yourself or put yourself at risk, we find that there are cases where you're allowed to. Rav Moshe Feinstein's example is for the sake of a livelihood. You can put yourself at risk and even others at risk, he says, providing they enter into it knowingly. And we mentioned three possible areas of value in contact sports, specifically martial arts. One of them being earning of a livelihood, the other one being acting in ways helpful to the self, and the third being a survival skill of self-defense, which is an inherent right in Jewish law. Finally, there's one issue which, of course, doesn't apply to most sports but would apply perhaps to certain martial arts, is the issue of pagan practices, superstitious or pagan practices. Those who are familiar with certain of the martial arts, there are some of them that do have practices in them which have their basis in Eastern religious practices and have their basis in Eastern beliefs. Right? And these are prohibited by the Torah. The Torah tells us, do not walk in the ways of the pagans. B'chukotehem lo telechu. Do not walk in the ways of the pagans. Now, what's the definition here? So, how do we define what the way of a pagan is? I mean, are there any pagans that wear glasses? Can we wear glasses? Well, why isn't that the ways of the pagans? How do we define it? What would be our definition? A ritual. How about shaking hands? Is shaking hands a ritual? Morning, Bob, how are you? Is that a ritual? What's a ritual? Hard to define. So, okay, let's say it's not essential, but it's something they do anyway. So I'll tell you what the Ramah says. Rav Moshe Isserles, in the Code of Jewish Law, says the following. He says, it's only forbidden regarding customs of the pagans that are based on sexual immorality or a statute of their religion that has no logical reason, which we suspect is blemished with pagan symbolism. Customs of pagan that have tangible physical benefit are permitted. So, for example, let's say I can't see too well. I go to this pagan doctor and he says, oh, he says, I have just the thing for you. He says, if you take these, it's got glass in it. If you put these over your eyes, right, Gugu, the god of glass, will bless you and you'll be able to see. Right, now, we happen to know that the glasses work by changing the focus, right, focusing the rays, right, so to adjust for the problems in the focus of your eyes. Okay, but so since there's a logical, tangible physical reason that wearing glasses will help me, I don't have to accept his crazy explanation. But supposing he says, you can't see? He says, put the glass on your head and it will cure you because the pagan god of glass, well, that I wouldn't be allowed to do. So if there's tangible physical benefit, I can do it. Because there I can accept my explanation, I don't have to accept their explanation. So, for example, this doesn't happen. This is a totally theoretical example. Teacher says, do push-ups. Because when you do that, you draw energy from the god of the ground. That's stupid, right? We know that's not the truth. We know that doing push-ups is very helpful for forearms and triceps and shoulders, right, and stomach and back, etc., etc. Right? It's a great exercise, right? It's got nothing to do with drawing force from the god of the ground, for heaven's sakes. Okay, so now, that's how we look at things. Is this practice that I'm being asked to do, which is part of this martial art, is there a tangible physical benefit with a logical explanation, not resorting to metaphysics? If there is, I can do it. If there's not, it's prohibited. So for example, this is real, right? Let's say there's a certain art, martial art called ninjutsu, which was actually the art of assassination. That was very, it's a Japanese martial art. And I had a student at Or HaSameach who was had an advanced degree, advanced black belt in ninjutsu. It was there about 20 years ago. He actually advanced black belts in ninjutsu, taekwondo, judo, and karate. Quite a dangerous fellow. Right? I pretty much allowed him to ask any questions he wanted and, you know, just speak as long as he wanted in class, no problem. Right, so this guy he told me that there are certain practices in ninjutsu which are based on witchcraft. He says they hold their hands in a certain way, which actually the Kabbalists say you shouldn't hold your hands that way. It's very interesting, right? The Kabbalists say you don't hold your hands that way. But the, in ninjutsu, there's a certain thing called kujukiri, which is a way of incantation, a way of putting a whammy on someone, putting a curse on someone by holding the fingers in a certain way, etc. So that would be prohibited, because there's no rational explanation, there's no physical, tangible explanation for that, not supported by logic, cannot do it. However, in many, many of the martial arts, karate, taekwondo, etc., they have what's called kata. Kata are these stylized fights where you do the moves very slowly. So you'll like stand there, you know, you'll stand there in kiwadacha, and then you'll move into different stances and throw a punch and do a block and etc. So you do it very slowly. Okay, now doing this kata, which you know, very slow movement, slow exercise. Right, that's permitted because there's tangible physical benefit. Slow exercise also works as exercise, and repeating the movements over and over again imprints them in your mind so they become reflexive when it is required to actually do them, God forbid, in a fight. So that will be permitted. Now, there are those who, for instance, some of the interpretations of what is done in the kata are actually interpretations based on pagan gods. Of actions that they may say, Kali, the god of war, does this, so you have to do that, etc., etc. You don't have to accept the pagan explanation, and you can do the action providing there's this tangible physical benefit. Tai Chi. Right? There are people who talk about Chi means a type of an inner force or inner power, right? Or Ki in, right, they call it in Japan, right? Chi, right, in yoga they call it Prana. Right, a force that you channel through the body. Now, whether or not that such a force exists or not, I don't know. Right, and it's not really relevant because the exercises in Tai Chi are martial arts exercises. People are not aware of that. You see, there's all these very beautiful, elegant Tai Chi moves. They're actually all actually fighting moves. Right, it's just not taught in that way to most people. So, for instance, person does that. Right, that's actually a blow to the nose with the back of the hand. Right, wham. Right. Very painful, right? Or, you know, the moving to the side like that, right, is actually if someone pushes, the move to the side, hand behind the head, ram, as you, you know, as they come forward, right? So, they look elegant, you know, but they're actually, you know, quite vicious, moves, right? But again, they may say that they are designed to increase the chi, the energy in the body. Now that may be a pagan idea, I don't know. Right? I don't know if there's any physical evidence for such a thing. But it's not, that's not the point. The point is if the exercise has a tangible physical benefit, I'm allowed to do it, and I don't have to accept their explanation. Now, what do we call tangible physical benefit? So, interesting, the Meiri, number 10, gives two criteria. He says, if it's logical that it should help, even though I have no statistical evidence that it helps, he says, that's okay. He says, what if I have statistical evidence but I don't understand the logic? That's also okay. This, by the way, is a general rule regarding medical practices, etc. Right? Is it something which either logic supports, even if there's no statistical evidence, or statistics support it, even though there's no logic? For instance, there are certain drugs that are used which actually work. We know they work. There's massive statistical evidence they work. But physicians' best reference might say mechanism unknown. What does that mean? It means it doesn't work by magic. We just don't know exactly the mechanism by which this works. We just know from statistical evidence that it works. That's not magic. That's not paganism. You're allowed to do it. Or it may be that we say, you know, logically this should work. This should help this muscle, this should help this health thing, this breathing should help me here, etc., etc. Then, but I don't have any statistical evidence to support it. That's also permitted. It's only those actions which have no statistical evidence and no logic, those I have to suspect that maybe it's a magical or pagan practice, and that I have to refrain from doing, even in the context of the martial arts. Right, so that's really the major issue, some of the major issues in martial arts. So I want to point out the halakhic process, how we go back to the Gemara, and from the Gemara we try and derive what the practice will be, what the practicalities will be when it comes down to Jewish law. Just by the way, one question people often ask is, what about bowing to the person? Right, in many martial arts, before you have a kumite, a fight, you bow to the other person. That's okay. You're allowed to bow to someone in that way. You cannot prostrate yourself on the ground in front of the other person, right? Which no martial arts, to my knowledge, requires you to do that. But bowing to the other person is like handshaking. You know, everyone seen Peter Sellers, right? You know, the party? Where he's like, you know, like this, like they bow and he puts his hand out and he bows and they put their hand out and they're standing there like this. Right? But in Japan, in many Eastern countries, the method of handshaking is just like bowing. And that's okay. That's not a sign of worship. What if the sensei, the teacher, says, now let's bow to the picture of what's his name or whoever it is? That you cannot do. Right? That already you cannot do. That's not a gesture of respect for another person. That's bowing to some intangible. That's bowing to a picture. And that's something which we should not do. We should avoid. So those are some of the ideas, and that's pretty much it. So you can go ahead and engage in contact sports, right, with the conditions that I mentioned, and martial arts, etc., and as long as you do it with the right intention in mind, and as long as you have the full consent of the other party, you don't pull a volunteer off the street and use him in sparring, right, but that's basically the rule. Okay, thank you very much. Thank you.